The reason I believed I should recuse myself is because I was involved in the campaign. To a degree, I think it would have been perceived is that I wouldn't be objective in participating in an investigation
right.
that might involve the campaign. I do not confirm or deny any investigation. I just felt like I should clear the air, and we're moving toward that end even before this latest flap.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking with Fox News last night about his decision to recuse himself from any investigation into Russian meddling during the presidential campaign. The move comes after reports revealed Sessions met twice with Russia's ambassador during the campaign. Sessions was one of Trump's leading surrogates on the campaign trail, and as an in-depth feature in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine reports, he, along with advisor Steve Bannon, is behind Trump's nationalist message. So now, as attorney general with broad powers to reshape immigration, criminal prosecution, and voting rights, how could Sessions push his nationalist agenda? Emily Bazelon wrote the Times article, and she's here now. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, you say the working relationship between Bannon and Sessions is really quite crucial to understanding some of Trump's major goals. Tell us more about their relationship.
They became close in fighting against immigration reform in Congress. So we're talking about 2013 and 2014 in particular. And at that time, Sessions was on the right edge of the Republican Party in the Senate in his opposition to immigration. And Bannon was the CEO of Breitbart. And so Sessions was going on the Senate floor, warning against all the harms he sees as coming from immigration. And Bannon at Breitbart was covering Sessions a lot, really pumping him up and giving him quite flattering coverage. And there's a particular moment in 2014 where Breitbart throws a party and Sessions is there. And there was a writer from Vice, Reed Cherlin, and he interviewed Sessions. And Sessions said, you know, you might not think it, but Breitbart gets a lot of credit for killing immigration reform. So there was a kind of simpatico tandem they were doing together.
Right. And then Sessions' aide, Stephen Miller, is now a key part of the White House and is also one of the architects of the president's anti-immigration stances, correct?
Exactly. And he embodies the tie between Sessions and Bannon. He went from being Sessions' top aide and really drafting a lot of the work that Sessions was doing and collaborating with Breitbart in its coverage. There was even a happy hour between Breitbart staffers and Sessions staffers that Miller organized. And now, of course, he's in the White House with Bannon.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're both known for painting this dark picture of America today, upping statistics on violent crime and immigration and voter fraud, making it sound like it's really anarchy out there in the inner cities. What do they gain from that, from stoking these fears?
I think that they are really appealing to Americans' baser instincts in terms of who we welcome into the country and how Americans feel about the changing demographic profile. So there are a rising number of immigrants coming in, not a rising number of illegal immigrants, I should clarify, but a rising number overall. And they're mostly coming from Latin America and the Middle East and Asia. And that means that the country is becoming more pluralistic and less white. And that is threatening to people like Sessions and Bannon and Miller. They are really trying to hold the tide and bring revert the country's identity to an identity that is more European and Christian.
But in general, crime is pretty low. Right. And immigrants don't commit more crimes than native born Americans. In fact, fewer crimes statistically.
That's right. No, that's right. And so there's a way in which these fears are being exaggerated and hyped in order to paint this picture of the country as being in disarray because of minorities, because of immigrants and because of African Americans in the inner city. It's not an accurate picture. It's at odds with the statistics, as you just said. But it creates this climate of fear in which then it justifies executive orders like the one that banned refugees and travel from majority Muslim countries.
Okay, and let's talk about how that would play out in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, because this Civil Rights Division is likely to be a lot different than President Obama's Civil Rights Division.
That's right. So I looked at three areas. One of them is voting rights. The Obama Justice Department was in favor, as the president would say. They wanted to help make voting easier rather than harder. And so when Texas and North Carolina passed laws that restricted voting by requiring voter IDs and doing things like closing polling places, ending same-day registration, the Obama Justice Department sued those states with a bunch of civil rights groups. And it was essentially arguing that the states didn't have any real reason to limit access to the polls in this way, and that these new state laws were having a discriminatory impact because voter ID, for example, is something that affects more African Americans and Latinos because they tend to be less likely to have the required forms of identification. So we are already seeing a real reversal on the part of the Sessions Justice Department. They went into court this past week and said, we don't think that Texas's law intentionally discriminated after all. We're going to switch sides in this case. And so that's an example of the kind of real difference, real just reversal of position that we are seeing from Obama's civil rights division to the Trump Sessions civil rights division.
Well, could there be something to the fact that it's not based on racial animus, on intentional discrimination, but based on political calculations in that minorities are more likely to vote Democratic and white people are more likely to vote Republican, and that's what they're most interested in?
Well, for sure, there is a lot of overlap there, right? And if you're, it helps Republicans when fewer people vote generally and when fewer minorities vote. So you can see that as simply, you know, Republicans preserving their power and doing what's best for them in a partisan sense. But the fact that it has this racial overtone also means that if Republicans are trying to make it harder for people to vote and they know they're affecting minorities more, that doesn't really give them an incentive to address the needs of minorities in their platform and their messages, right? It's kind of banking on an older strategy of having a really white voter base as opposed to expanding that voter base.
Now, what is Sessions likely to do when it comes to oversight of police departments, such as the Chicago Police Department, which has been accused of police brutality, police misconduct, and other police departments where the Obama administration had pursued consent decrees?
Well, here again, I think we can expect a real shift. And Sessions has already talked about pulling back from oversight of local police departments. Before he was in office, he expressed huge skepticism about consent decrees. These are the court-monitored agreements that the Justice Department has reached in the past in order to achieve police reform. So, you know, the Justice Department goes in, they find a pattern or practice of civil rights violations, like the police department using force in a way that's unlawful or that particularly affects minorities, and then they try to work out a way to fix this stuff, often with a lot more training. That's one particular mechanism. Well, if you're against consent decrees and you don't think a court should monitor those agreements, then that suggests that you're not interested in trying to have that kind of reform role and that oversight of the of local police departments. And indeed, in this past week, one of Sessions' first moves as attorney general was to say that he wanted to pull back from oversight of the police. And he couches this in terms of making communities safer by essentially unbinding the hands of the police and letting them do their jobs. But community members who have felt preyed upon by the police and worried about police abuses felt like the Justice Department was coming in and making police departments better and from their point of view, safer. So that's the kind of tension and tug of war.
And he had actually spoken out against Black Lives Matter activists, right?
Yes. That's right. And, you know, Trump has been the most vocal of all in really calling Black Lives Matter activists a threat. And essentially, rather than seeing protests as a warning that something was wrong in a city, that the police were not necessarily doing their work in the way that was the best for the community, the president and Jeff Sessions always want to give the benefit of doubt to the police. And that means that, you know, one imagines there will be another unarmed shooting that will provoke protests in this country. And it's easier to imagine Sessions and Trump really cracking down on the protesters than it is to imagine them asking for a civil rights investigation.
Let's talk a little bit about this Russia story. I mean, it took a newspaper article for this to come out and for Sessions to eventually recuse himself from this investigation. You could argue perhaps it was the same thing with Michael Flynn. Had journalists not uncovered his conversations also with the Russian ambassador, he would never have resigned. What does it tell you about Sessions' role, whether or not he would stand up to presidential wrongdoing and investigate something that, you know, that might go counter to what his boss wants?
Well, look, I mean, normally the role of the attorney general is to work with the president and the executive branch to defend what they're doing and augment it and put their justice agenda into play. But we also in history have had moments where we really need the attorney general to be independent. And this was a big deal during Watergate. There were two attorneys general who stood up to Nixon and resigned rather than fire the special prosecutor who was investigating Nixon. So the million-dollar question for Jeff Sessions is whether he would do the same for President Trump. Sessions was one of Trump's chief campaign advisors. He helped craft Trump's immigration policy, spoke for him a lot on national security. And now his role, given these meetings that he didn't disclose with the ambassador, looks compromised. And I think that explains why he decided to recuse himself from these Russia investigations. But, you know, the broader question remains, because there may be other moments in the presidency where standing up to Trump would be the kind of conduct the American people would want to see from the attorney general. And obviously, he's still in that role.
Yeah. Well, how fatal do you think it is, this scandal involving the Russian ambassador, to Sessions' larger agenda?
I think it's a big distraction, and how fatal it is will depend on what the investigation reveals, right? I mean, we still don't know what all the facts are by any means, and it's going to depend what actually took place and what the intelligence community is able to discover. So I think that very much the jury is out on that question.
Emily Bazelon, staff writer for The New York Times Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, Jeff Sessions wants to sharply limit immigration, setting up a fight with California, which is now considering a bill that would provide legal help for people facing deportation. We'll find out more about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Most undocumented immigrants facing deportation hearings have two options: pay for a lawyer or represent themselves in court. They are not entitled to a public defender, but that could change here in California. A proposed state law would provide attorneys for immigrants on a case-by-case basis. And if passed, this would likely be the largest legal defense program for immigrants in the country. And here to tell us more is Hiroshi Motomura, law professor at UCLA. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And Jasmine Ulloa, she's been covering this for the LA Times. Hi, Jasmine.
Hi.
Well, Hiroshi, let's begin with you. What constitutional rights do undocumented immigrants have when they come into this country?
Well, the undocumented immigrants, or immigrants in general, anyone in this country has a right to procedural due process, which is lawyer speak for a fair day in court and fair hearing and a fair opportunity to know what the evidence is against you and to present your best case and to insist on the rights that you have under the laws.
So they have a right to a hearing before a judge?
There's a due process right to a hearing. Now, the tricky thing about this is that because in theory deportation is not a criminal punishment, you don't have the same type of public defender system that's paid for by the government that you have in criminal law.
Okay, so they are not entitled to representation under federal law.
They're entitled to representation, but they have to pay for it. So that goes mm-hmm. back to how you opened, which is that you can represent yourself, or you can pay for an attorney, but isn't in many cases, it's hard to find a lawyer or you can't afford one. And so you end up being in a situation you're representing yourself. And it's quite clear that having a lawyer makes a huge, huge difference. And that's because the law is so complicated that many people have the right to stay here, actually, even though you might think that they're here unlawfully.
But often you have Border Patrol catching and putting people immediately in detention and sending them back across the border without a hearing, right?
Well, I mean, the Congress provided for that, but the difficulty with that, and this is in a sense a different kind of situation as you're talking about. I mean, you're talking about the border. People really haven't come into the country, and so there's a procedure for that. But I think we're talking here about people who have lived in the community for many, many years, you know, because undocumented migration from Mexico, for example, is really slowed down to kind of a net zero at this point. We've got people who've been in the community for many, many years with U.S. citizen children, and so that's quite a different situation and quite a bit broader, you know, due process rights and a right to a hearing, the right to a day in court than you have in the border situation.
Okay, Jasmine, so tell us about this proposed law, SB 6. What would it do?
So it would, right now lawmakers are asking for $12 million from the general fund. And that would be allocated to the Department of Social Services. And that agency would contract with legal services providers to provide counsel and attorneys for immigrants.
For any immigrant?
For right now, it's all immigrants are eligible to apply for services, but those with a violent felony on their record would have to have high chances of winning, and so it would go on a case by case basis. The legal service providers would screen them, and if they have chances of winning their case, then they can petition to represent them.
And are there enough lawyers available to represent them? Enough who know about immigration law?
No. I mean, it's definitely an area where there are definitely not enough lawyers to do this right now.
Right. So, Hiroshi, what does that set up then if there aren't enough lawyers and yet, let's say this law does pass, there is a right to representation?
Well, I think that the question of how to best allocate the money is a tricky one. But I think that, you know, we're going to be seeing there are lawyers out there who have the knowledge. The problem, you know, and I haven't run the numbers on exactly how many cases there would be and how many lawyers are adequately trained. But the fact is that part of the problem right now is that with everyone who is in immigration court trying to find a lawyer and having that be such a difficult process, it would be much more efficient system, and you could, if people really do have the right to stay under the law, which I think is true in many cases, it'd be much more efficient, and you would really make a big, you would really offset the capacity issues if you had a system for saying for screening people and for representing people. It's in the same way that if you can imagine, if we didn't have a public defender system and you ever had to go find a lot of lawyers, it would look like there weren't enough lawyers. But a lot of the problem is really not ultimate, you know, capacity. It's really connecting people with the help that they need.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I recognize that there's a shortage, but I'm saying that you could do a lot more and help a lot more people.
Right. And do you think $12 million is enough?
Well, you know, it's a lot of money, but I think that these are very complicated. These are complicated cases. So I have not seen the studies, I have to admit, on exactly how far that would go and any people that would represent. But you know, one of the things that's related to your question is that you know, a lot of people think that it's very clear whether someone's in the country illegally and they should be deported. But the Congress has set up a system that's incredibly complicated and. You know, you really need a lawyer to figure out exactly where you stand under the law. You know, people who are here undocumented actually do have extensive rights to stay, depending on their individual circumstances.
So, what are some of those circumstances that would give them a right to stay?
Well, everything from being a crime victim to applying for asylum to being a longtime resident who is able to apply based on their family situation, being allowed to stay in this country, to something that was for example, a deportability ground based on a criminal conviction that it turns out is actually not a criminal conviction at all, or a criminal conviction that is not within one of the categories that you're deported for. So, you know, a lot of this is, I think one of the big myths here is that being in the country undocumented or in the country unlawfully is such a easy to see black and white sort of thing. But Congress has set up a system that is very complicated. And, you know, one of my concerns is that by not having a fair day in court, that you're really, you know, tearing breadwinners away from, you know, U.S. citizen family members. And that's something that this bill is trying to address as far as I understand it.
And so even though this is a federal issue, immigration, it would still be legal for California to wade in and provide state resources to immigrants.
Yeah, I don't think there's any legal issue there. I mean, all you're really doing is saying we have a community here that where there's a lot of families with different kinds of immigration status. Some maybe one member of the family has an immigration problem, and so it's certainly within the normal jurisdiction and traditions of a city or a state to say, you know, we're going to help out the community here. We don't want our businesses to be disrupted by losing employees who actually do have a right to stay in this country, and we don't want our families to be disrupted because, you know, their loved ones are taken away when actually that's not what the law says.
Now, DHS Secretary John Kelly wants to expedite removals of people who have been here for a while. He says there's a backlog of more than 500,000 cases that are slowly wending their ways through the courtroom. And he's saying that he wants to maybe look at removing immigrants who cannot prove that they've been in the country continuously for 2 years. Would that pass constitutional muster?
Well, I think there's some real problems the way that statute is written, because that statute allows the secretary to expand what's called expedited removal on a nationwide basis, but the statute's written in such a way that it only applies to people who have not been in the country for 2 years. But one of my concerns is that it's going to be left up to a single immigration officer in the field to decide whether the person's proof they've been here for 2 years is good enough. And so, you know, that's a concern. And another concern is that even if someone has been here for under 2 years, they do have constitutional rights, and they do have claims, let's say, for asylum in this country. And they have also not just asylum claims, but other kinds of claims. So if a single officer is going to be in the position of being able to be, you know, judge, jury, and executioner, then it saves money. But justice is something that requires a commitment, and that's the reason, you know, we have an immigration court backlog, because Congress hasn't paid enough money, has not established enough immigration courts.
Hiroshi Matamura is a law professor at UCLA and author of the book Immigration Outside the Law. We also heard from Jasmine Ulloa, politics reporter for the LA Times. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we want to hear from you now. Do you think tax dollars should fund legal representation for undocumented immigrants in California? You can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, some good new movies and some not so good new movies.
This is a woman you can still build a movie around. Just not this movie, because this movie is garbage.
We'll find out what he's talking about in our weekly film segment next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Wolverine's Last Stand this weekend, which is where we will begin this week when it comes to new releases. Dave White and Alonzo Duralde both review for The Wrap and host the Linoleum Knife podcast. Welcome back, you guys.
Hello.
Howdy.
Howdy. Okay, let's begin with this X-Men flick, Logan, starring Hugh Jackman as Logan.
Logan, what did you do?
Charles, the world is not the same as it was. Mutants. They're gone now.
Wow, it almost sounds like a Western.
Funny you should mention that. This is a movie that keeps reminding you how much like Shane it is, but it mostly deserves the comparison. It is very much the sort of aging gunfighter's one last blaze of glory kind of movie, only instead of guns, he has those claws that come out of his knuckles. So this is the last of the Wolverine movies we keep hearing from Hugh Jackman, and it is an R-rated superhero movie, which is still something of an anomaly, which I think we have Deadpool to thank for that one. And they use the R rating in interesting ways. I mean, you know, Professor X now drops some F-bombs, and the violence is pretty intense. Ultimately, this is a superhero movie, and it kind of follows a lot of that stuff, but it benefits from a movie that's not going to have a sequel, so they don't have to set stuff up, or, you know, you don't have to sit through the credits for any little buttons at the end. It's, you know, there's a button at the end. It stops, you know.
He die?
I'm not going to say that. But I'm just going to say that it doesn't have to work into
single-handedly ruining.
Yeah, not going to talk about that.
This segment of the show
is called "Tell Me the Ending" with Madeline Brand.
But you know, they don't have to worry about setting up what the next four movies are going to be. So that's nice. I like this movie a lot. I think the action sequences are really great. The pacing is not always as on point as it could be. There were moments where I kind of felt like, all right, let's get on with it a bit.
Did you?
I did. Yeah, and I've been reading some really gushy reviews, and if people are loving it that much, more power to them. I like this movie a lot. I think it's really great. I think it's one of the best of the X-Men films. I think there is a danger in overpraising it because it does break out of the superhero paradigm, and thank goodness, but I think it could have done more.
Dave, will you gush or not?
In general, I am not the gusher. I am the one who gushes less. But I think even the quiet moments in this film really work effectively. First of all, do not be a terrible parent and take your child to this movie. Do not take your child to this movie.
So it definitely earns the R rating.
It is a hard R, and the violence is extreme, and the aftermath of violence is seen, and it's brutal. Mm. Do not take your children. How many times should I say that?
Wow, now I don't even want to go. You scared me.
But the impact of the violence is thematically important because it calls, you know, it calls into question the idea of, okay, you're a superhero, but how good are you if you're killing all the time? And there's so much killing in this film.
Is there a plot besides the killing?
Yes.
Okay.
It's set in the future. The mutants have apparently disappeared from the face of the earth. And then they come to find there is at least one and maybe more young children who, for one reason or other, have similar abilities. And Logan is kind of the only one left to sort of protect them from these sort of corporate / science bad people who are trying to get them.
And the one that he takes into his custody is a little girl named Laura, played by a newcomer. Her name is Daphne Keene, and her performance is nearly silent. I guess she's about 9 or 10. And watch this child in the future, because with no words, she gives a really impressive and brutal performance. Hmm. And she fights bad guys and kills them and stuff, which is fantastic. But yeah, the relationship between Logan and Laura is really, I think, the core of the film, and it is more emotionally resonant and feels like there is more at stake with them than in any end-of-the-world scenario that you would see in, let's be real, almost every other superhero movie.
Okay, let's move on to Before I Fall. This is a teen melodrama, and here is a clip.
What do you think people will say about you when you die?
I think I care.
I'm serious.
That we're hot.
Hey. Watch the road.
We need music.
Watch out for the truck.
What truck? I wanna get
out. Okay, what's happening here, Dave?
What's happening here is a combination of Groundhog Day and Edge of Tomorrow and Heathers and Mean Girls. Zoe Deutsch, in this film by director Rye Russo-Young, is a very popular high school senior. She runs with the cool girl crowd. And within about 5 minutes of this film, if you are a thoughtful person in the audience, you think, Oh, all of you are terrible.
Yeah.
You're very bad kids.
We've seen these girls before.
You're not nice to anyone,
yeah.
and you think you're so great. This dawns on Zoe Deutsch eventually when she goes to a party and the humiliation of another student takes place at the party. They leave the party.
So then you've got Carrie mixed in.
Kinda, yeah. You leave the party and there is a fatal car crash. Zoe Deutsch's character is killed. And upon death, she wakes up in her bed and it's the same day starting over. So when I say Edge of Tomorrow, I mean Edge of Tomorrow. She is killed, she wakes up. She is killed, she wakes up. And this goes on for days, possibly even weeks. And over the course of her reliving this day, she has to sort out who she is, who her friends are, why they behave the way they do, and how maybe she can correct.
And maybe not die.
The amount of cruelty that they inflict on everyone around them. So it is a much better film than I anticipated. I've already seen a teen death fantasy from a year or so ago called If I Stay, which is about a girl in a coma who has to decide whether or not she wants to live or die. This one is in service to something much more kind-hearted and much more thoughtful. And so as a tween to teenage targeted film, it's pretty effective.
Not your demographic, let's be honest.
You know, I mean, here's the thing. When you become a teenager, your mortality suddenly becomes, you become aware of it. And because you're a teenager on that bridge between childhood and adulthood, the first thing you do is make it all about you in an extremely narcissistic and romantic way. And so the teen death fantasy becomes something really glorious. This film does traffic in that, wouldn't it be great if I died for some beautiful reason? But like I said, it's in service to something smarter and kinder and more thoughtful than it might otherwise be.
Okay, well, let's swing to the other demographic. This one stars Shirley MacLaine. It's called The Last Word, and she plays a curmudgeon who wants approval of her obituary before she dies.
Now, I have determined there are four essential elements to a really great obituary.
Is that right?
That's right. One, the deceased should be loved by their families.
Right.
Two, the deceased should be admired by their coworkers.
I know.
Three, the deceased must have touched someone's life unexpectedly. And if said person was a minority or a cripple, so much the better. Fourth, that's the wild card. I do not know what my wild card is.
Okay, so she's talking to an obituary writer there, Amanda Seyfried. What happens next, Alonzo?
Oh, brother.
And do we care?
A lot of phony baloney. I adore Shirley MacLaine. I just presented her with a Career Achievement Award at the LA Film Critics Dinner this year.
Well, you're not friends anymore now.
Well, look, this movie is not her fault. She's great. At 82, she still has amazing comic chops. Like, this is a woman you can still build a movie around. Just not this movie, because this movie is garbage. It does not have a genuine emotion in its bones anyway. You know, there's that line about preferably a minority or a cripple, and it's, you know, it's funny to hear an old lady speak that way. But then she literally does start mentoring a young black girl played by Anjua Lee. And the movie just treats the girl like a prop the whole time. I mean, they never get past the joke of preferably a minority, you know. All the stuff that she's supposed to be doing, that's supposed to be fixing her life, that of course fixes the lives of the people around her, none of it rings true. Her wild card, she winds up going to work as a DJ at an independent radio station. I know! It comes out of nowhere. She and the station manager have these, like, starry-eyed conversations about the Kinks and vinyl albums that are not remotely believable.
I'm sure that would happen.
I know.
Someone who works at KCRW, that happens all the time.
Yeah, I have been in or near a lot of conversations about the Kinks and vinyl albums, and none of them were like the ones in this movie. I didn't buy any of it. And I just felt bad for Shirley MacLaine and Amanda Seyfried because they are so good and they are so empathetic and charming and funny that, you know, they're trying to bring the movie with them and they just can't. It's so ham-fistedly put together. And on top of it, kind of weird weirdly shoddily produced. I mean, Mark Ballington has been a filmmaker for a long time. He did Arlington Road and Mothman Prophecies. He's done a ton of television. There are just basic things in this movie that you would see in like a first-time film where like scenes will end a couple seconds too quickly, you know, in an abrupt way, or the camera's in an odd place.
Do you see the boom in the shot?
Somehow they missed that one. But there's just a lot of little technical things where you're like, who's running the store here? This is a real disappointment because I would love to see another great vehicle for Shirley MacLaine, but this does not make good use of her.
Okay, so skip that one. Last up, let's talk about Love Song, starring Riley Keough and Jenna Malone.
Hey! Oh my God, it's been so long. I just feel like I'm going crazy. It's okay to feel a little crazy, but it's not fair to you to have to do it all by yourself. Let's go have some fun. Where do you want to go?
Okay, so it's two young women, friends, having some fun.
Riley Keough is a young mother who is feeling the pressure of that. And her husband is never around. He's always off on business trips. She takes a road trip to meet up with her college best friend, Jenna Malone. They have a great time. They get drunk. They kiss. Mm-hmm. Then the next morning, after, you know, fade to black, Jenna Malone has to, oh look at the time. I must be leaving.
Gotta run.
And this wounds Riley Keough's character. She does want more. Not only this friendship, but a romantic relationship. And neither one of them ever talk about it. The second half of the film takes place a few years later at Jenna Malone's wedding to a man. Riley Keough shows up. She's not in the wedding. And you know that's weird. Your best friend's not in your wedding party. And the remainder of the film is their attempts at reconciling who they are and where they want to go and what they're going to be to each other. Mm-hmm. It is, as someone we know said, it's an almost lesbian romance. And it's a very beautiful looking film. It's from So-Young Kim, who made In Between Days. So this makes her second movie with a Cure song as the title. It's sweet and it's tenderhearted. I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that really relies on the actresses because there are pages and pages of dialogue that's not there. There's a lot of glances and looks and awkward silences that they have to imbue with meaning, and they do. I think Keough and Malone are two of the most interesting actresses working right now, and they have a very sort of lived-in relationship in this movie. Like, we buy them as people who've known each other for a long time and who are sort of harboring all these feelings that they're not able to communicate with each other. One interesting thing that the film does is that the first segment and then the later wedding segment have two different cinematographers. So they actually have kind of a different look. And
was that done on purpose?
It was, yeah. I think it very much kind of underscores the differences in where they are in their lives and how they view the world and how they view each other. It's a succinct movie, but it's one that you really have to allow yourself to sort of pay attention to all the things that aren't being said because so much isn't being said.
Interesting. Yeah. And I didn't know this little tidbit, Riley Keough, granddaughter of Elvis Presley.
That's correct. True.
She's a fine actress. She was just up for a Spirit Award for American Honey. She's on The Girlfriend Experience on Stars. She's terrific.
And the minute you know that fact, you will look at her and think of Lisa Marie, and you will think about how they both look like grandpa.
Yeah. I know, with that face, that long face. Okay, Alonzo Duralde, Dave White, they both write for The Wrap, and they both host the podcast Linoleum Life. Thank you.
Thanks.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The new film, Donald Cried, is about what happens when you go home. In it, Peter is a big city guy who has escaped his working class hometown in Rhode Island to become a success on Wall Street. Donald is his high school friend who never left. He still lives with his mom, still gets stoned, still listens to heavy metal, still sports a mullet from his high school days. Everything Peter escaped as soon as he could.
Look, I don't like this place. Do you understand? I don't like how I feel when I come back here, all right? So if it's been 20 years, then it's fucking been 20 years. I'm sorry, I don't like who I am when I'm back here, you understand?
Peter is talking to Donald in that scene. He's come back to take care of his dead grandmother's affairs, and he winds up spending the day, reluctantly, with Donald. Chris Avedisian stars as Donald, the film's mullet-wearing man-child. He also wrote the screenplay and directed the movie. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks. And joining us, Jesse Wakeman, who also stars in the film as the uptight banker Peter. Hi, Jesse.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. So Donald is definitely, he's kind of odd, right? He's sort of cringeworthy, mainly because he's unfiltered. And I just want to play a clip of tape to illustrate how off-putting he is and how frustrated Peter is at first to be with him.
Just looks so much different now. Mm. Your skin just looks tired and worn, you know, and I just thought like when you left, you became like a bounty hunter or something like that. So when you came back home, it would just be like you on this fucking motorcycle cruising down the street on a big hog with just, and everybody, the whole neighborhood's just coming out and your fucking like hair is just flowing. Your muscles are all fucking jacked up. You have weapons and everything.
Like, this must be pretty disappointing then, I guess.
Okay. So, Jesse, you're playing Peter there, who seems pretty perturbed, pretty annoyed by Donald. He represents everything Peter, as I said earlier, tried to get away from. What is he escaping? What was he escaping?
Peter is escaping, this hometown that he wanted to get away from. But I guess more importantly, like an older version of himself, you know? I mean, you leave and you grow and you kind of take on a new identity. I think you go back to these former places and it forces you to return back to a former self to some degree. And Donald kind of forces that. I think for Peter, he's a little bit more of a complicated and troubled character because his identity isn't so set in the first place. I don't think things are going so great for him in New York.
Hmm. So he's not as successful as he seems as a banker.
No.
And Chris, Donald is definitely not successful. But he maybe he never wanted to be.
Yeah, or it depends on how you measure that, I guess. But but he's not financially successful, though.
But why is he so attached to Peter, to Jesse's character? Why is he so insistent that they spend the day together and really spend time together?
Like you would with any great friend. I mean, I really just think those are like the best times of his life, his childhood, which a lot of people look back at their childhood as, you know, maybe not necessarily high school or junior high, but for Donald, who's, I think, has always been comfortable with the type of person he was and is, you know, he looks back at those times very fondly, regardless of how he's been treated. That stuff just never really, really bothers him. It does, but not in a way that would kind of taint his memory of him and Peter's time together. So I think he's just really looking to spend time and just reconnect with this guy who he really, truly loves.
And talk a little bit about how you decided to play the character, because like I said, he's wearing this mullet. I mean, he looks kind of weird and out of date, and he's got this real sort of childlike openness to him, but also people are put off by him. How did you come up with this character?
Well, I mean, it started with the voice, and then, you know, when we did the short, I feel like the short was heavily improvised. So I think the character was just kind of found through the process of making the short. But I have kind of a running thing where I annoy Jesse or kind of inherently play this annoying character, I feel like. In real life. So it just kind of came out organically.
I mean, he's also really funny. You played it for laughs as well, too, right?
Yeah. I mean, that stuff is... I don't know. We just think about the character and what he's, you know, I don't know. It's always tough. But yeah, I'm glad people find it funny.
And you guys created the story together, right?
Correct.
Yes.
And so, Jesse, did you know Donald in your real life? How did you come up with this idea?
Yeah. You know, I mean, and I think a lot of people connect with the movie that way. I mean, you hear people say that, like, oh, I had a Donald, you know. And for me, yeah, I did. I grew up in a small town in Northern California. I had a close friend that I think about, you know, to this day, that kind of there's a strong connection to this Donald. You know, I like to think that I'm more adjusted than Peter is, you know, and I was able to kind of navigate that relationship and returning home, et cetera. But yeah.
Are we supposed to like Peter? Because he comes across as the protagonist at first and you're kind of on his side. And then you find out he's really done something cruel to Donald, which is why the title of the movie is Donald Cried. And then I at least started feeling very complicated feelings about Peter.
Well, that's really nice to hear, because that's very much what we were trying to do, you know, and I think that's what differentiates this movie from a lot of them, is that, yeah, we're definitely playing with the audience's expectations, you know, in a kind of ping pong way. It really does go back and forth, like in real life, you know. I mean, people have a lot of different colors, you know. It's like, people are bad, people are good, people have done bad things, you know. And yeah, from the outset, it would seem that it would seem that Peter is the, you know, quote unquote good guy, the straight guy, someone the audience can identify with. And then slowly, as you kind of make your way in, that starts to unravel, you know. But like you were saying too about Donald, I mean, he has so many colors, you know. He's both very annoying, but also very sweet, but also a little manipulative. You know, he's a little smarter than he might seem. So yeah, you never know really quite where to stand throughout the film.
Yeah, because Donald is holding Peter hostage for the first half of the film, pretty much.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it.
Which is, you know, so you're kind of like, well, who is this guy? This guy's, he's kind of creepy and he might do something really bad. And that sort of keeps you on edge. I want to play a clip of tape of when the two of them kind of break through the tension, and this is when they go to spread Peter's grandmother's ashes. And let's listen to the clip.
Give bless to God for creating Nana. And I want to thank her for all the chill shit she used to do with us and show me stuff. Thank you. Amen.
Amen.
Can I do one?
Okay, so that's Donald giving the sort of eulogy. And by do one, he means spread some of her ashes. And so this is a great moment where they're both joined, but in this very solemn activity, but it's also absurd in a way. And Chris, I just want to ask you about that scene and what it signifies in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think it signifies their kind of bond. So, you know, at this point, it's like they're coming together. We can kind of move forward and kind of get to the other stuff, kind of maybe the deeper stuff that's bothering Peter and, you know, what's been affecting their relationship, you know. And it's over, of course, death and mourning and kind of that little mini funeral.
Yeah, and it's really shot in a bleak landscape in this town in Rhode Island in the dead of winter. Why did you guys set it there?
That's where I'm from. That's where I'm living. So, you know, I really like Rhode Island. In the winter, it can be a dark place. And yeah.
So in a way, this whole leaving and coming back and, you know, that Peter's trying to come to terms with where he grew up, is that something that you actually feel with living in Rhode Island, in this town?
No, I mean, I've spent time away from Rhode Island, come back, but I mean, I feel like I've laid waste to places I've lived, or, you know, conversations or whatever at a party, or while I go home at night and lay in bed and think about all the stupid things I probably said. And then if I was to see that person the next day, I may come across like I'm being arrogant or something, but it's just because I feel like an idiot for something I think I may have said. I mean, speaking to high school, how I could have mistreated people or had mistreated people. And again, if I saw them today, I'd feel bad for what I did, so I'd come off a certain way. So that's kind of where I really identified with the material, was just expressing this kind of guilt that I kind of feel like I carry all the time.
So
to take it really dark and, you know.
I mean,
it was a guilt. I mean, I want to say too, like, I'm sorry, but like, you know, we had this dynamic with kind of the fool and the straight man. And then, you know, it was a good idea for Jesse and I, and a good way for us to work together. And I think, you know, we could have had it be, you know, simple or more broad. I hope it's not too broad, but like, it was really just about making these two guys interesting and the seeing a dynamic we see all the time, but just treating both of them like a human beings. And mm-hmm. I just think that's it.
I couldn't help but think that when we're talking about the election and politics and the two Americas, that these two are pretty good representations of that, of the class differences in this country that we're so aware of right now. Did you see it that way when you were making the movie?
I mean, I would just say, you know, we weren't explicitly thinking about that kind of stuff at all. I mean, I think we were really focused on the characters and trying to tell kind of a truth about these people. But absolutely, I mean, this is like the fun and magic of creating something like a movie. You get the chance to tap into these things. You know, people pull a lot from the movie that we weren't necessarily consciously really working on, but that run in the movie. And I think that's there.
Yeah. You know, yeah, this stuff just kind of finds its way in. And the movie being called Donald is just by chance, you know, but now suddenly that has taken on this whole new thing that I wish we weren't necessarily connected to at all. But unfortunately, yeah. So it's interesting how that stuff happens.
The movie is called Donald Cried. Chris Avedisian and Jesse Wakeman star in the movie, and it opens in Los Angeles today at the New Art Theater. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Madeline. Thanks for having
Thanks
us.
Thanks so much. Thanks Great talking caring. To you.
And Julie Myers is here now to round out the week with some listener comments.
That's Hello. Right. And I rode in on a motorcycle with my hair streaming with weapons. It was super amazing. Donald was pleased.
You and he could really, I could see you two. Just.
That might be the meanest thing you've ever said to me. we talked about Jeff Sessions at the top of the show, and a lot of our listeners were talking about the fact that he needed to recuse himself, which he did yesterday, from investigating himself, presumably. Yes. Joel Fogelson said, man, it's basic legal ethics here. If there is an appearance of a potential conflict for an attorney on an issue, the attorney should recuse themselves of working on that issue. It goes all the way up to the top, folks. Lots of other people weighing in, and you also out there can do so at KCRW Press Play on Facebook.
Okay, thank you. Julie cried. I'm Madeline Brand. Yeah. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane. The Kane Foundation is committed to enriching the cultural and civic life of Los Angeles. For over a decade, the Kane Foundation has made strategic grants to make Los Angeles a better place to live for future generations.